Okay, welcome to the podcast. Today we have Alex Bea joining us. Alex Bea is a staff data scientist and manager of data science technology advancement here at Anadarko. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks, Leo.
So Alex, you've worked on a lot of, I know, really interesting projects since you've been here. You've been for a while. How long have you been here for again?
Come up on like 2.5 years.
2.5 years. Okay. Yeah. And pretty much the whole time you've been just exposed to like lots of different interesting data science and machine learning since you started, right?
Yep. Absolutely.
So what would you say are some of the more interesting oil and gas projects that you've leveraged data science and machine learning for? If you could just name a couple.
A couple that come to mind that I've worked on that really have been heavy hitting in the machine learning. The first one is what we call our TOPS propagation tool, which really is around the area of rapid basin exploration, where geologists are trying to go into a new area of development or exploration. They have a ton of well logs. That's logs that have been measured while wells have been drilled that are now publicly available. And the geologists are taking all this information and trying to put together their sense of what lies beneath the ground. We're trying to use machine learning there to help augment the geologist to do something that would normally take 9 or 12 months for a team down to about 1 day for a single geologist. And emphasis on the augmentation part. We're not replacing, but it's really helping somebody to do their work more efficiently so they can do some more exciting stuff beyond just the mundane clicking between software trying to build a 3D conceptual model. Basin. Now that's TOPS propagation tool. The other project that I've been working on more recently is what we're calling fault segmentation. So a hot area of research in oil and gas around the seismic domain has really been automated fault detection. So you take a 3D seismic volume, you chop it up in slices along one way and then the other. And then use your machine learning algorithm to figure out where there's faults and where there's not, more importantly, where they're at. And you get a 3D volume out of this of just zeros and ones indicating, hey, you've got faults in these areas. But on its own, that 3D volume is not the most useful to geologists or geophysicists because then they still have to go back and figure these things out in 3D and say, okay, well, these ones all correlate to one fault itself, and then this group of ones, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It's something that it does help the geophysicist, but they still have a lot of legwork to do. And so what fault segmentation is, we're going to take this cube of zeros and ones, and we're going to decimate it down into individual fault entities. We're going to figure out which group of ones in this cube, so to speak, belong together, and then we're going to give them a label. And then export that into a format that can be imported then into the geophysicist software.
So it sounds like in both of these, is it fair to say that there's kind of a similarity in both of them are trying to kind of shrink a huge amount of time that would be taken from geos basically beforehand? And then now this is going to help them go a lot faster to do these things?
Exactly. It's all about augmentation. We're really trying to take away a lot of the simple mundane tasks. And I don't want to use the word automate, but we're really trying to figure out what is it that's repetitive about their task that we can extract and use machine learning to help take care of.
Yeah, so they can maybe do something more interesting and more useful with their time.
Exactly.
Like that, fair to say.
Exactly. We're not trying to replace people. We're just trying to help them do more exciting stuff.
Okay, so why don't we look a little bit more into that first one that you were talking about? So the TOPS propagation tool. So if I understand the problem more or less, you've got these well logs where people had drilled wells in the past, mm-hmm. and they take little readings every so often, yep. right, throughout the well?
Maybe like every half foot they'll measure gamma ray, resistivity, rock density, neutron porosity. Those are the four I can think of right away, but I think there's like six or seven. Total.
Sure.
Yeah.
So they have these wells, they've drilled down, they've taken these measurements, and then you want to basically try to correlate which areas, if you take two well logs side by side that are close to each other, you should see kind of similarities throughout mm-hmm. the two well logs, right? And yep. you want to try to kind of correlate certain parts to the other part and kind yep. of align the two well logs. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, alignment is more what I would say. Like, you can, if you've put them right next to each other and you've kind of mapped their true depth one to the next, you should, if they're really close, they should look very similar versus depth. But as you start to get further and further away, they're going to look a little different. So well log A versus well log B, let's say well log B is now 5 miles away from well log A. At some depth, you might notice, I see something extra in well log B in these depths. So you can imagine everything below that would be shifted down where you would normally see it versus well log A, for example. And so it's a process where really a human has to go through and figure out, okay, I see this signature in well log A. Where do I see it in well log B? And then you have to kind of just work your way down the depths and yeah. figure out where they correlate from one to the next.
And for the geos, if I'm not mistaken, they'll basically kind of pull up side by side a whole bunch of well logs, and you can just visualize them as like a squiggly line kind of.
Yeah.
And you'll pull up, let's say, two of these squiggly lines next to each other and kind of manually try to see which signal patterns kind of look mm-hmm. the same in the two of them. Is that yep. about right?
Yeah, that's about right. But they're not looking for just like any random squiggle. They have ways of looking at, so if we're looking at just the gamma ray and resistivity tracks in these logs, they have ways of identifying the different formations based on how the signals have reacted versus a depth. So they could say, okay, well, this is a shale here, for example, and we think that it's this formation. So let's see where we find this same exact signature in the corresponding well logs over from it, in that panel that you said where they'll pull up multiple. So yeah, that's what they're just looking for. They've identified these. We want them to identify what they're looking for, and then we try to help them propagate that to the rest of the well logs.
So yeah, what were the approaches? How did you kind of get started? So you want to basically take one well log or a piece of that well log and figure out in a neighboring well log what's the corresponding. Can you kind of talk about how you started on it, maybe how did you approach the problem, and then maybe a little bit about how you ended up getting to where you were at on it, which I believe is a neural network, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we're using a convolutional neural network. But where we started, it was kind of Quentin Tarantino style there, talk about the end, then we're going to go back to the beginning. Okay. Where it all started was an ideation phase, which is how I like to start all my projects. Just, okay, how do we take the problem? How do we decimate it to something so simplistic that also describes the problem as it is? And for us, we kind of saw this as not well logs, but we saw it as a time series analysis where depth is time. And then we're just looking at the signal versus time. We just happen to have different measurements versus time. And so you see people maybe thinking of this, well, it could be a stock market analysis where you've seen this same signal happen before. Can we predict where we see it again at a future time kind of thing? So ideation, going back to this, ideation was the initial component. We tried all sorts of different analysis techniques out there. Continuous wavelet transforms was part of this.
Dynamic time warping, did that come up in this at some point?
That was one thing I was just about to mention. Dynamic time warping is actually a technique that's been tried by the industry for decades.
Can you explain super quickly what exactly is dynamic time warping? You're kind of trying to take two, let's say, like sound wave files yep. maybe or something and kind of match them together?
It's exactly what you think, how you explain it there. Let's say you've got two pieces of audio signature, for example, and you know they start at the same place and they end in the same place, but how they map in between those start and end points is the dynamic part of it. You have to figure out, time series A and time series B, where can you find the point in time series A along time series mm-hmm. B? So you chug along time series A and you figure out, okay, do I have to go ahead or backwards in time series B to find the same exact point? It's kind of almost like a matrix where a diagonal, if you were to go mm-hmm. yep. diagonal along it, that would represent them being exactly the same, but any deviation off of that, any curvature off of that, represents that stretch or squeeze between A and B. And it's used in more applications than just audio. They also use this in fingerprint analysis and image analysis, a lot of applications for it.
And that sounds very similar to the well log matching up.
Yeah. So that's what we thought, okay, well, maybe we've got a variation of it that we can give a try and solve this problem, even though people have tried this for decades.
Yeah.
Problem we kept coming around to was really is fixated on this. What we found, you really need to have a common stop and start, but well logs are not all drilled the same. Some go deeper, some go shallower. There really isn't commonality there. So we needed something that was robust enough to where it could get by the fact that they're not going to be the same window of depths overall. And if you don't have a perfect diagonal, it's not a big issue. So that, going back to it, this ideation phase. Yeah, we looked at dynamic time warping. I think we even looked at like rotated dynamic time warping. We even had another firm out there working on their own special version of it. We looked at like audio fingerprinting. So like when you hold up your phone and you have it listen to a piece of music to figure out, you know, who sings it and what the name of the song is, we thought maybe that might help us. We looked at algorithms like that. But ultimately, there was a Kaggle competition. We happened to find this research that was done. It was a Kaggle competition for examining brain waves from a zebrafish. It's like, you know what? This, you know, if you take the spatial component, because there was a spatial and time component for us with well logs across a basin. That's the spatial component. And their time component was our depth component. And now keep in mind, we have multiple tracks in our well logs. They have...
Well, did they have a spatial component? What was their spatial? Or was there like multiple fish or something?
They had, you know, one brain, but they had sensors
in place. Different areas
of the brain. Different areas of the brain.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool, interesting. That's actually pretty neat,
Yeah, so we found that.
So each area of the brain should kind of have like a similar, like you can map certain regions of the signal to other certain regions of the signal.
Right, so you see like over here... in one area of the brain, you see a signal pop up at a certain time, but then maybe just some spatial distance away from it, you see that same signal pop up, but at a different time.
Uh-huh.
And so they were trying to figure out, how can you map
the two?
When signal A or signal in node A gets to node B.
Uh-huh.
But there were differences there that we had to overcome. They only had one signal. We've got many.
Yeah.
And it was a bit of a simplistic model. So we ended up evolving from that ourselves. We added more inputs.
So that was a Kaggle competition.
Yes.
So there was, you might have to remind me how this works. There was like a winner of it or something. And you were looking at like the top solutions to the competition to kind of draw inspiration from. Was that kind of how
it was like the top three solutions, I think.
Okay. And were they all using neural networks or?
I'm kind of scratching my head on this one here. I think most of them were neural networks.
Okay.
I just remember there was one, I think he was in the top three, he or she was in the top three. They had a GitHub repo around that. And I remember finding it thinking, okay, this, and they had a paper.
Uh-huh.
And so the paper described the network and then just kind of reverse engineered it from there.
Very interesting.
And then evolved it.
Okay.
And we've come a long ways since then.
And so I know you can't say exactly the details from that point on, but can you say like a little bit about kind of the general like windowing and a little bit about the neural network at all?
What I can say is we had to collaborate with our geologists a lot. Simply mimicking this neural network from Kaggle wasn't enough, because what I thought might work wouldn't work in reality. So I had to go sit with a geologist and figure out, what are they doing? And so by looking at them do these well correlations, seeing how they zoomed in and out, kind of gave me the idea, well, we need to be able to zoom in and out on the well itself to figure out, okay, maybe there's different levels of correlation here. So that's one thing we took into account. You kind of alluded to it as windowing, but it's really just kind of like how you're zooming in at different scales on the well log. Because if you're looking, obviously, a very fine scale, yeah, you might find the same signal from well log A 200 times in well log B. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at it very finely. Maybe you need to zoom out a little bit and take a look at the bigger picture. And so we wanted to build a network that was robust enough to figure out how to do these correlations regardless of the zoom. So we had to build something robust enough to do that, which means a lot more training data, which means we had to work with the geologists to help give us their intuition of what are good correlations and certainly what are bad correlations. So sitting with them, working with them, iterating with them day by day. There was a time where we got these massive GPU supercomputers in, and all of a sudden it went from iterating on a weekly basis to iterating with them on a daily basis.
So you'll just kind of try something new, sort of hand it off, let them take a look at it and see if it looks like it's kind of working correctly, and you just kind of go back and forth with them.
Exactly. They tell me what they like, what they don't like. I try to sit with them to see how they overcome the problems it's having, incorporate that into the new model or how we feature engineer, and then let the network train overnight and go back to them first thing in the morning after we've grabbed coffee. Coffee was a big component. It's a big component of a lot of data scientists' lives.
So that was a really interesting project, and let's go to that other one that you mentioned. So you mentioned about faults.
Yes.
So can you refresh a little bit on what that other problem was that you've looked at, and kind of what's going on with the different solutions on that? You're trying to kind of pick out faults from seismic data. Is that about right?
Well, the picking of faults from seismic has already happened, let's say, at this point. We have a wonderful team that are brilliant and able to do that with high accuracy to a very, very great degree. But essentially what they do is they're going to take a fault seismic cube, they'll run their network on it.
Can you mention a little bit what that is exactly? A fault seismic cube?
Well, it's a seismic cube. And what they're doing is they're getting the faults out of it. So they'll
a seismic cube. This is basically whenever you do the seismic exploration, you shoot the sound waves or whatever into the ground, right?
Yeah. So you've shot sound waves into the ground. You have an array of microphones. You know the distances to all those microphones from where you shot the sound, and you do some complex computations to figure out how they've reflected through the subsurface. And so you've got this complicated 3D signal that has been, I don't know the exact computations behind it. And to be honest, I'm not an expert or even anything near an expert in seismic, but I just know it's a very complex 3D cube.
Uh-huh.
What I work with is the derivative of that, which comes after that. So the team here, they have methods of looking at this 3D cube, and they'll slice it up, not in the Z direction, but in...
And Z, which direction is that?
From Z is like you're looking down
into the ground?
Yeah, surface looking down. It's along gravity, let's say.
Yep, sure.
They won't slice it in that way, but they'll slice it in the other two axes. Mm-hmm. And they'll go through, they'll run their network on it and figure out where the faults lie. In a 3D cube. They'll export that, and we get a 3D cube that is zeros and ones, so to speak, that say, yes, I have detected a fault here.
Okay.
Now, a geophysicist with just a cube of zeros and ones, they still have to go back and identify where the faults are and what their individual extent is. You could have hundreds or thousands of faults in a study. And so if you have to go map those by hand, it's almost just as if you were mapping the faults yourself without the computer. I mean,
because it just gives you back one, essentially kind of like one giant fault of everything that is a fault. Is that kind of fair to say?
Yeah.
And you want to pick out like which ones are the actual individual faults.
The individual entities.
Individual entities, yeah.
Yeah. So it helps them if they need to go discretize these on their own, because it helps them maybe pick up things they would have missed when they are drawing these out in 3D on their own. But they still have that huge effort of going through navigating in 3D space, mm-hmm. and outlining these faults. And so what we're doing, we're taking this product, this cube of zeros and ones, and we're trying to figure out, okay, which group of ones all link together, and which, you know, where do they not link together? So we can decimate this into individual entities that are, hey, this is a plane and this is a fault.
So maybe you can tell me if this is right or not. Like, let's say you had two faults that kind of intersected, mm-hmm. each other and had like an form like an X, let's mm-hmm. say. You might try to like take that X and take it apart into two separate individual faults.
Yes, instead of just one.
Yeah, which could be difficult because they're like connected to each other.
They're connected, like, yeah. They intersect. And yeah, you've got that interaction there. But it's not impossible because a human can do it. Uh-huh. And so that's where we're at right now, is we're trying to imitate what the geologist does, or the geophysicist, I'm sorry, what the geophysicist does as part of, you know, part of the task. Ideation, let's start with that. You know, let's look at ideation. How do we break this down? We found papers out there for crack propagation algorithms. You know, how do you put together a crack from an image of sidewalks, for example, or streets? How do you track streets from satellite images? All these algorithms out there that do similar tasks, how do we use them to our advantage? But like I said, with the TOPS propagation tool, let's sit with a geophysicist and see how they do it. Yeah. Because in the end, these algorithms are simply art imitating life. We need it to do what it is that they're doing, but we've got to learn how they do it. We've got to figure out what it is that they are intuitively doing under the hood. For example, going back to the TOPS propagation tool, matching signals. Well, you know, you didn't have to learn how to match signals when you were in college learning how to do marker propagation or top propagation. You figure out how to do pattern matching as a kid. I've got a young child at home who I'm teaching how to recognize squares and triangles and circles. So if you think about it, this all stems back to the time when we're kids, where we learn how to match things. And so we're trying to cram all of that into these machine learning tools. So going back to the fault segmentation, sitting with them, we're trying to figure out what intuition is it that they're doing under the hood that we need to solve this problem.
Okay, and just to conclude this first part, I know you can't tell the exact details of how you architect the solutions, but could you say like a couple of the high level like methodologies that you used to separate these different faults out?
I can say there is a lot of image analysis that goes on under the hood, but I mean, that's pretty broad because there's so many different techniques that fall into that. But image analysis, deep learning, Bayesian statistics, it's just a conglomerate of a ton of different things going on all at once. And it's been a process. We've been working on this since August of last year. And like I said, with that ideation phase, I mean, we've tried a ton of different things. And I want to say for every 10 things we try out, maybe only one pans out to being part of the solution. Mm-hmm. So to give you a hint, I mean, it's very broad, but that's in the realm we're thinking.
And that's going to wrap up this first part. Thank you very much for sharing about those projects, Alex.
Mm-hmm. Anytime.